It's like a
The Not So Basic Training Podcast featuring Suzanne Gust. And now, here's the Not So Basic Training Podcast.
Now we're going to talk about how people learn, a subject that is very near and dear to my heart. And you may be thinking to yourself, well, I don't care how people learn. It's your job to be the trainer. But you should care how people learn because you're teaching things to people all the time. You tell them how to fill out a form. You teach them how to use a machine. You teach your children how to do things if you have children. You explain something to a spouse. It's important for every person who interacts with another person to understand how people learn. And I'm only going to talk about three of the things that people need, but there's three very important things. One, they need comfort. They need to, number two, know how whatever it is that you're doing relates to them. And three, it needs some kind of an emotional trigger. And I'm going to repeat those three again and again. Comfort, relating to them, and triggering an emotion. But I'm going to take each one separately. Comfort. People need to feel successful, and they need to feel comfortable, or they won't learn. If they at all feel nervous, their brain shuts down, and nothing gets in. If you've ever been in a situation where you were panicked trying to learn something very quickly, you'll know that you can't learn anything. You shut down. It's like a brick wall goes in front of your eyes, and you don't even see anything. So let me tell you how most people shut down learning, and I'll just use a classroom example. They make people very stressed out. The first thing that you'll do in a room full of people when you're in a classroom is they'll say, we're going to go around the room and introduce ourselves one by one in front of the rest of the group. In training, there's such a phrase as level of socialization. Level of socialization means that we socialize with comfort at one level more than we have comfort at another. And the most comfortable level of socialization is one-on-one, one person talking to another. The next higher level of socialization, where not as many people feel comfortable, would be small group, two, three, four, five people. But once we connect with people one-on-one, we can socialize with up to six other people. The last level of socialization is with a whole room full of people, above six. In most people, in fact, 96%, they estimate, feel uncomfortable in a situation where they have to speak or interact in front of more than six people. So let's go back to what we do to people. We're going to sit in a class of 30 people and let each person go around the room and introduce themselves in front of the rest of the group. As a trainer, you never want to do that. As a person in business, you don't either, because you just increase the level of stress and lower the level of comfort. So why do you need to know that? Because even if you're running a meeting, you can't expect someone to walk in a room and have no fear in front of 20 other people and begin speaking. So you want to have some kind of a warm-up or gentle conversation before you ask people for input, just understanding the levels of socialization and how people learn. 2 years ago, I was at a training conference, and up on the wall, they had a poster. And it was a poster of people's greatest fears. The number one fear, greatest fear of people they'd surveyed, was being burned alive by fire. That was the world's greatest fear of these people they had surveyed. Second only to being burned alive by fire was public speaking as the second fear. So if that puts it in any kind of framework for you so you'll understand how many people may fear just speaking in front of more than six people, you might not put anyone on your staff on the spot anymore. Now, we're still on the subject of comfort and people learning. There's one other way we provide comfort when people learn, and we start with something they know. Before I teach you anything new, I want to start with what you already know. If I'm going to teach you problem solving, the way that I would always start that would be to ask you about problems that you normally have. For instance, if you have children, I'll ask you, what do you do if your son comes to you and says he has a sore throat? And most parents would say, the next thing I do is I feel his forehead, or I ask him if his tummy hurts. And I said, what do you do when you call the doctor? And they say, we describe that he has a sore throat, but not a fever and not a stomach ache. And I said, well, let's go back and look at the steps you just took to problem solve. And the first step is you identify the problem, a sore throat. You gather a little more information, which is he doesn't have a fever and he doesn't have a tummy ache. And then you have the ability to describe it in those exact terms to your doctor or the next person. Those are the steps of problem solving, at least the first couple steps of problem solving. And why would I start teaching someone that way? Because we start with what they know. It provides comfort, and they want to learn more. Also, if I'm teaching ergonomics, let me relate that to you or to someone. I ask someone in the audience to pick out a car that they wished they could own, one that was just fabulous. Recently, in one of the classes that I had taught, a woman said that she wanted a big black Ram truck. And I had her picture it for me, and she was talking about chrome and headers and all sorts of things. And mentally, she had this picture of a big black truck. And I said, imagine that I give you that truck, but that's the last vehicle you can have the rest of your life. And it doesn't come with any replacement parts. How well would you take care of that vehicle? And she said, well, I'd change the oil all the time, and I'd make sure I only use the best gas. And I said, now that is something you'd do if you could only own one. Let me relate it to you. You only get one body. And because you only have one body, what kind of fuel do you put in it? And do you warm it up before you drive out of your driveway, or do you start work without your stretches? Do you see how I'm creating comfort by starting with something that relates to that person? We start with comfort. The next place we go when we train someone or when we know someone needs to learn something is we relate it to them. I just related the truck to that woman. And I want her to think before she goes out and does her job about warming up and stretching, just like she would warm up her vehicle before she pulled out of a cold garage. I'm relating it to something they know. The other way to relate it to them is to get them to do it, hands-on. If I'm teaching someone how to fill out a form, the worst possible way to get them to learn that is to put the form in front of me, fill it out for them, and say, do you get it? Do you get it? Do you have any questions? The best way would be to hand them the form, hand them the pen, and go through section by section and ask them some questions. What do you think goes here? Why would that be important? Now they're involved and it's relating to them. If they walk away with a sample they filled out, they have a much greater understanding than one that you gave them. The next and last subject of learning would be an emotional trigger. People remember things that have an emotional trigger, and emotions can be good emotions or poor emotions. I'm going to ask you to think of something. Think of a date that occurred over 2 years ago that you can remember exactly what the weather was like. Just any date over 2 years ago, and I want an exact date that you can remember what the weather was like. April 1, 1992. It was a little cloudy, but beautiful, and the sun was shining through some clouds in a way that just looked like it had streams, and it was about 70 degrees, April 1, 1992, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Why do I remember the weather so well? Because that was the day my son was born. When I looked out the window, it was an emotional trigger that caused a memory. I bet if you thought of a date, you thought of the date you were married and what the weather was like. You thought of the date you graduated and what the weather was like. But there was an emotional trigger that made you remember that. So when we're teaching people, if you want them to retain the information that you're giving them, you have to trigger it with emotion. What do we do? What do we do that triggers people's emotions? In driver's ed, you know what they used to do to trigger our emotions? They'd show us pictures of car crashes. So we didn't have those car crashes. They try to trigger our emotion. Even as a parent, I know that I read about things like, see, this child went to jail because he used drugs. I'm trying to trigger an emotion with my child so he learns. My dad has a unique training method. He used to walk me along the sidewalk as a five-year-old, along the road, and he'd point out dead squirrels. And he'd make me get down and touch them because he wanted me to see what it was like if you got run over by a vehicle. He was trying to trigger an emotional response. Now, I do remember that very well, but I wouldn't recommend that training technique since dead flat squirrels are pretty nasty. But let's look at why this emotional trigger works and how you can use it. You have two sides of your brain. The left side of your brain is very logical. It is the place that stores historical information, and that left side of our brain rationalizes everything. The right side of our brain is creative and imaginative and loves color and sound and music. The right side of our brain has emotion. The left side of our brain is logic. If I try to pack more into the left side of the brain of an adult learner, it is already full. They will retain 3 to 5% in the left side of their brain if I give them something in a logical manner. They'll try to retain it, but it's so full with information, their minds will go, I already know something like this, so I don't need to retain anything new. Ever tried to teach someone something that gave you that, somebody something that gave you that response? I don't need to learn it. I already know something close to that. Or they try to tell you what they know about the subject rather than listening to what you know about the subject. It's because they're in their left brain. The right brain can retain 100% new information. But you got to figure out a creative way to get to the right brain. As trainers, if you ever go to our classes, we use music when you walk in because it's a right-brained activity. It gets you in that mode. We got to pack some stuff in there. If you think about our tapes that you've been listening to, I tell stories because that's an emotional trigger. It puts you in that place. Did you think of me holding my dad's hand and petting dead squirrels when I was talking about that? A story puts you in an emotional place. So why tie an emotion into training or into learning? Because it's the only way people remember things. You tell people a story and they won't forget it. And it'll help them understand the point you're making also. I forgot one time in filling out a capital request form to put my budget number in. It's an accounting code that goes in the upper right-hand corner. And I just forgot. And I turned in the form. And instead of getting my capital request approved, it was sent back to me with a note that said the capital committee wouldn't be meeting for another month. I missed getting some equipment because I forgot the stinking code that was supposed to go in the upper right-hand corner. I just told a story. If I were to tell that story while I was teaching you how to fill out that form, you wouldn't forget to put in the budget code because I triggered an emotion. Even though it was my emotion, I triggered one for you. When you're training, the least effective way you could possibly get anyone to learn anything new would be to tell them. The most effective way is to trigger an emotion, to make them feel comfort, no stress, and to relate it to them. Pick anything you're trying to get someone to learn. Start with what they know. Make it one-on-one if you can, and get some emotional response in there. Here's another way you can get emotional response. When they do it right, you can praise them because that's an emotion. We don't use that one enough. When my son comes to me and I say, absolutely excellent job setting the table. You put the knife and the fork on the exact size they're supposed to go. Brilliant. I triggered an emotion and he learned. If I ignored it and there was no emotion, there'd be no feedback for him. He wouldn't necessarily retain the information and he wouldn't know I cared. You use emotion a lot in training children. You can tell them, don't touch that cup, it's hot. But until they feel it, they don't understand it as well. So sometimes, even in learning, we let people fail just a little bit so they have some emotion and they don't want to fail again. So where are you going to use this information? You have people learning 100% of the time around you. You're telling them how you want them to pick up the telephone and answer it for you, how to fill out a form, how to use a machine. And if you want them to retain the information, you've got to provide comfort for their learning, relate it to something they know, and trigger an emotion. I'm going to tell you a story. And I'm going to tell you a story for two reasons. One, to show you how a story can trigger an emotion. But the story is also about making someone else successful. And that's really what learning is about, making somebody else successful. There's a phrase that I use in training. It is more important to be a guide on the side than a sage on the stage. And if we keep that in mind, more important to be a guide on the side than a sage on the stage, then we'll automatically be more concerned about what the other person is learning and how successful they are versus how great we are as a teacher. So let me start my story. At a learning disabled school in Brooklyn, New York, there were some children gathered together for what seemed to be the end of the year kind of fundraising dinner. Now, this school caters to both children that can be mainstreamed into conventional schools and those that cannot. As typical of a fundraising dinner for this school, some parents are asked to say a few words. One parent of a disabled child, a father, was asked to stand up and speak. And after saying how wonderful the school was and how dedicated the staff was, he said something else that left everyone quite pained. Where is the perfection in my son? Everything that God does is with perfection, but my child can't understand these things as other children do. My child can't remember facts and figures as other children do. Where is God's perfection in my child? The audience was absolutely shocked and looked in pain. And the father stood there, still with his piercing query. I believe the father answered, that when God brings a child like this into the world, the perfection that he seeks is the way that other people react to this child. And he began to tell his story. One afternoon, the father and his son walked into a park. And as they were walking, the son noticed some other children playing baseball. The son asked, "Do you think they'll let me play?" And the father knew that the son was not very athletic, didn't appear so, and most boys his age wouldn't want him on their team. But the father also understood that if his son was asked to play, that it would give him a wonderful sense of comfort and belonging. And so the father approached one of the boys and asked if the son could play. The boy looked around for guidance from his teammates, and after getting none, he kind of took matters into his own hands. And he said, "Well, we're losing by 6, and the game's in the 8th inning. I guess he can be on our team. We'll try to put him up to bat in the 9th inning." The father was absolutely ecstatic, and the son smiled broadly. The son was told to put on a glove, go out and play short center field in the bottom of the 8th inning, and the team scored a few runs, but was still behind by 3. In the bottom of the 9th inning, the team scored again, and now they were there with 2 outs, the bases loaded, and with the potential winning run on base. And it was the son's turn to bat. The father wondered, would they put him into bat? Would they give him a chance? They had a chance to win the game. Surprisingly, they handed the son the bat, and everyone knew it was going to be impossible because he didn't even know how to hold a bat properly, let alone hit with it. But he stepped up to the plate. The pitcher moved a few steps, lobbed the ball in softly, so at least he'd be able to make contact. But with the first pitch, he swung, clumsy, and missed it. One of the teammates came up to the son, and together they held the bat and faced the pitcher and waited for the next pitch. And the pitcher again took a few steps forward and tossed the ball softly towards the son. As the pitch came in, the son and his teammate swung and swung that bat. Together they hit the slow ground ball to the pitcher. The pitcher picked up the soft grounder and could easily have thrown the ball to the first baseman, and the son would have been out, and that would have ended the game. Instead, the pitcher took the ball and threw it on a high arc to the right field, far beyond the reach of the first baseman. Everyone started yelling, "Run to first! Run to first!" Never in his life had the son run to first. He scampered down the baseline wide-eyed and startled, and by the time he reached first base, the right fielder had the ball. He could have thrown the ball to the second baseman, who would tag out the son, who was still running. But the right fielder understood what the pitcher's intentions were, and so he threw a ball high and far over the third baseman's head. Everyone yelled, "Run to second! Run to second!" And the son ran towards second base as the runners ahead of him deliriously circled the bases towards home. As the son reached second base, the opposing shortstop ran to him, turned him in the direction of the third base, and shouted, "Run to third!" As the son rounded third, the boys from both teams were now running behind him, screaming, "Run home! Run home!" And as the son stepped on home plate, all 18 boys lifted him on their shoulder and made him the hero. He had just hit a grand slam and won the game for his team. "That day," said the father softly in his speech, with tears now rolling down his face, "those 18 boys reached their level of God's perfection. They saw success in somebody else." That's learning. Seeing success in someone else makes you great in teaching them. Being concerned about their success more than your own makes you a great teacher. And in fact, that's how we develop people in business. We are as concerned about their success, or even more so, than we are about our own. What does that mean to you? That means that if someone learns best visually, you give them things visually. If you have to tell them and show them, you tell them and show them. You're concerned about them and their success. And the 3 things that I told you about their success: you have to provide comfort, relate it to something that they know, and trigger an emotion. Hopefully I've triggered an emotion today with that story that makes you want to go out and make other people successful.
This has been the Not So Basic Training Podcast. For more information, visit our website at notsobasictraining.com.
Produced by Converge Podcasting.